From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The big game is almost here, barring a blizzard. Atlanta is ready for Super Bowl 53. But how ready are Atlanta fans to welcome the New England Patriots and Los Angeles Rams to Dirty Birds turf? Erin Tarver is here to tell us more. She studies the philosophy of sports fandom at Oxford College of Emory University and is author of The Eye in Team, Sports Fandom and the Reproduction of Identity. And she's joining us now on the line. Hello, Erin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm going to out you first off as a Saints fan.
Yes.
Are you eating those We Were Robbed King Cakes or voodoo doll cookie shaped like refs we've been hearing about?
Rough. I have not joined the lawsuit that some fans are bringing to against the NFL. I'll say that. Then
you're talking to the daughter of a diehard Red Sox fan who, you know, had been following them for decades, and still, you know, the Boston Red Sox, Chicago Cubs. The Red Sox have done much better, but until 2004, it had become part of an identity to love a losing team.
Exactly, the lovable losers. I grew up thinking of myself as being one of those fans of lovable losers, that my team would always find a way to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. One of the things that I try to investigate is this phenomenon. So what is it, if it's not the thrill of victory, how do we account for fans' persistence in being loyal to a specific team? And what I try to argue is that actually fandom is way bigger than just the experience of the euphoria of the stadium. If you think about what fans do, there's a wide range of practices. We decorate our houses and our team's colors. We follow the minutiae of drama around coaching changes in the newspaper. We engage in debates with our fellow fans about who was the greatest quarterback of all time for our specific team. And all of those practices, I think, contribute to not only our sense of ourselves as fans, but also they go toward helping us build a sense of our own identity. And I mean by that our identity as human beings. So our belonging to a particular community, our being connected to our families, and all these other things that go into making us the type of self that we are.
Yeah, when you say identity, it's interesting that so many of us talk about sports as saying our team, or we lost that one, or we're going to win again.
Exactly. And this is quite ubiquitous in terms of fans, that fans, when they watch a game, when, say, your team loses, you don't feel disappointed for them, right? You don't say like, oh, poor those guys. That's really sad for them that they lost. No, when the Saints were eliminated from playoff contention, I was like, oh my God, I'm sad for myself. I'm enraged. I feel that something has happened to me, right? Or we believe that something has happened to us as a local community whose fortunes are bound up with that of the team on the field.
Well, so you're bringing up something. Is it identity or belonging? Or are they the same thing?
I would say those two things are inextricably bound with one another. In fact, when we talk about how it is that human beings come to be the kinds of selves that they are, we don't know ourselves in isolation from other selves. And so, in fact, what's quite important in the formation of identity, and we know this not only from philosophy, but from psychology, and in fact, childhood development psychologists come to similar kinds of conclusions, that a big part of forming what philosophers call subjectivity, that experience of being an I, a self, involves a couple of things. Number one, it involves knowing not only what I am, but who we are, right? The I in relation to a community to which it belongs. But secondarily, and I would say just as importantly, crucial for forming the I, is knowing who we are not. And I would say that this is one of the crucial features of sports fans and what they're doing in their sports fandom is not only loving a particular team and identifying with it, but also, in many cases,
hating the other team.
Exactly.
Well, I'm thinking of fans of the Atlanta Falcons were devastated when their team lost to the Patriots in the Super Bowl. This was just 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So now, what are Falcon fans going to be feeling as the Patriots descend on their turf? Do they hate on the Patriots, or do they unify around being Falcons fans who've been jilted, or is it a little of both?
My hunch is that very often fans who have been, let's say, jilted or who have had this sort of devastating experience of loss, particularly in the case of that Super Bowl loss, which involved a comeback victory by the Patriots, that what we see is this desire for revenge. And since the Falcons are not playing in the Super Bowl, the next best thing to revenge is a phenomenon. There's a German word for it called Schadenfreude. Mm-hmm. And Schadenfreude, as your listeners might know, means the pleasure we take in someone else's misfortune, particularly the pleasure that one might take in, say, the impending hopeful loss of the New England Patriots. So this is a really common phenomenon amongst sports fans, so much so that it motivates, in many cases, rooting for the downfall or the comeuppance, we could say, of a team who we want to be taken down a peg so that their fans, for example, might feel the same humiliation or devastation that we did.
Why in the world would anyone care about how well a total stranger can throw a ball? Well, that is a question asked by Emory University philosophy professor Erin Tarver. She's author of The Eye in Team, Sports Fandom and the Reproduction of Identity. But so people who are not into football, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, I'm going to hide out inside of my home all weekend, or I'm getting out of town and, you know, make a lot of money on Airbnb. How about those who are not sports fans? Are they getting, is the assumption that they are getting those identity needs met in some other kind of way?
Well, sometimes that discourse of saying, well, I'm not a sports fan, I'm going to hide out in my house.
Is an identity.
Exactly. That's a way of building up a sense of identity as well, and saying, like, I am rejecting the sort of mainstream understanding of what good entertainment is, or I'm actively, you know, suggesting that, you know, perhaps football is barbaric, or that I am above this sort of plebeian behavior or something like that. That way of relating to football, too, can function as the same type of activity of telling ourselves who and what we are.
How about the idea, however, that football is barbaric, or, you know, boxing is? But there are a growing number of people who do think, you know, I don't want my kids to play football. It's too dangerous. We're seeing what repetitive concussions due to a brain. It's exploitative of, or football players in the NFL have no regard for women, that kind of thing. Why then do so many of us keep on washing? Is there a rationalization in this belonging?
This is a question that I think those of us who identify as football fans need to be asking ourselves and looking at ourselves pretty carefully. As you say, it absolutely is the case that increasingly people are concerned about the health, long-term health effects of football, and that this is resulting in changes in behavior, particularly anyway, as regards parents' relations to their own children. So we do see in the last couple of years, actually, a drop-off in participation in youth football. And in fact, a growing number of current and former NFL players even say things like, I will not let my son play football. Drew Brees, the quarterback of the Saints, is one person I know of who suggested that he wouldn't let his son play football. So I think given that we know when we're talking about our own children, that there's something worrying about this, we ought to be asking ourselves why it is that we are willing to watch other people's sons continue to engage in this kind of, at this point, demonstrably harmful activity. Now, as a philosopher who's interested in questions of ethics, I would say this is a difficult question, whether it is, we would say, morally permissible to continue to play football. The most common response that I hear from fans, and I ask fans this all the time, about whether they think it is morally acceptable for them to continue to watch football, given what they know about the correlation between football and traumatic brain injury. The most common response is to say something like, well, the players are adults, They can make their own decisions. And so this doesn't have anything to do with me. I think there's two things to say about this. First of all, the mere fact that the people who are playing the game are consenting, that doesn't yet tell us anything about our moral status as observers. So it could very well be that people consent to do things that there's something really troubling still about our watching it for entertainment. But secondarily, I would say the question of consent here is a quite complicated one. And philosophers who study, say, medical ethics, a field which is really interested in questions of consent, will say there are a variety of factors that can compromise, that call into question our ability to participate in fully informed consent. One of the things that might compromise informed consent would be whether a person can fully appreciate the consequences of what they are consenting to. And so this is one reason why we would say that children, for example, cannot consent to medical procedures. They need their parents to do so because children lack the cognitive capacity to be able to fully appreciate what the risks associated with a procedure would mean. And this comes into play in the case of football because what we're talking about are people who have been playing football in many cases from the time that they were children. And so it's not totally clear that they have, from the beginning, been able to fully appreciate the consequences. Secondarily, the NFL has a rather checkered history in terms of making available the relevant information that players would need to have to be able to make fully informed consent. So for years, for example, the NFL attempted to discredit and then sort of slow down the advance of research into the long-term neurological effects of concussions. More recently, when they started supporting studies, it turned out that they might in fact be trying to influence the outcome of those studies. So it's not totally clear to me that players always have a full appreciation of the ramifications of continuing to play football, in particular because we just have not had a lot of information about this for a very long time.
So it's not just the players and the game, it's the actual power structure. Fan comes from the Latin fanaticus, right? You know, insanely sort of inspired, maybe divinely inspired on some level. But the role of the fan in supporting a whole system is what I'm curious about.
Fans are, despite the fact that we tend to know that there's something wrong here, fans remain attached to this practice because it has become part of themselves, right? They understand themselves, who they are, in part through their engagement with football. And so, understandably, there's resistance on the part of fans to critically interrogate this practice or to think about giving it up. But I think what we have to remember and remind ourselves over and over again, that the people in this practice, that the players on the field, under the helmets and shoulder pads, they are real people. They are human beings, just like our own friends and family and sons who we sometimes try to keep out of these games, and to take their concerns seriously when they're raising them.
Erin Tarver, she is Emory University philosophy professor. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Erin is author of The Eye in Team, Sports Fandom and the Reproduction of Identity. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Millennials are not as religious as previous generations. A report from the Pew Research Center found that 35% of Americans born between 1981 and 1996 do not identify with a religious community. We spoke with three ministers who are making efforts to engage with young folks in their community and to provide a space for their questions, doubts, and struggles. Anne Henley Saunders is from First Presbyterian Church of Atlanta. Wilbur Purvis is with Destiny World Church in Austell. And Kim Jackson from All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta. I started off by asking Kim if she's noticed a declining population of millennials at her church.
No. All Saints is a really vibrant and lively church. We have about 3,000 members, and we are of all ages and really a growing and vibrant place.
Okay. How about you for you, Wilbur?
We're close to the same. I do notice, like, High school through college age, there sometimes tends to be a dip with kids going off to school and, you know, changing addresses and whether or not they come back to church. So I have noticed a little dip there.
How about for you, Ann Henley?
I think Wilbur hit the nail on the head with change. I see a changing landscape within our context and within the global context of the church about what being a person of faith means and what that looks like.
Yeah, big, big picture stuff there. The Pew Research Center, however, shows more millennials, especially now, religiously unaffiliated. So younger people are leaving the church or never find their way in the first place. Anyone, why do you think? Kim, you're nodding, so I'm going to start with you.
Sure. So I am a millennial, and I recognize that most of my peers are not in church. And I think a lot of that has to do with some change in thoughts around what it means to be a thoughtful person, and that Christianity in particular has gotten a bad reputation of not being a place where thoughtful, intellectual people are welcome. And so I think that's a part of it. And also, I think a lot of people my age have been hurt by the church.
Yeah, we heard that from Jonathan Merritt. Right. And also someone from Facebook, Georgia, said, I left the church a long time ago. The hypocrisy of good Christians is one of my main pet peeves. But says that she discusses religion regularly with a coworker, a liberal evangelical. So that whole question of how do you discuss religion? How do you cross that boundary and have those kind of conversations with people who may not be believers. Is that something that you in your church are working with, Wilbur?
I think on the hypocrisy piece, that's always an interesting conversation to hear people bring up as it relates to the church. I think the church has to convey and say to our congregations and outside of our walls that the church is much like a hospital, that we're not attempting to present some image of something that we're not. I think maybe I don't know if that happened in the past or not, but I think we have to be honest and authentic and say that, you know, we're learning and we're growing and we're developing. We're not this perfect utopia. It's a hospital.
So a place to heal? You mean that way?
And because it's a place to heal, I expect people who are in need of healing. It's a hospital.
But no one's expecting a miracle cure. Or maybe they are.
I think they are. I think they think that that you're not going to have those issues. But I would never go to a hospital and not expect to see sick people. When I go to a hospital, I expect to see sick people who are on their way to healing and restoration and wholeness. But this whole hypocrisy piece, I want to admit that I have my own flaws, my own failures, and that I'm attempting as a pastor to reach a destination just like everybody else who is in there. And that is a place of wholeness, a place of healing, where I can become authentic, but it's a process.
So Ann Henley, you at your church, you work with a number of millennial and youth groups, and millennials are often described as, you know, disruptors, rejecting the ways of their elders. So how are you approaching that age group in particular, and addressing some of these issues that people bring with them? It's a place for hypocrites. You know, you may say one thing in the church, but you may behave a different way.
Great question. To Wilbur's point as well, I think that hypocrisy is part of our sin. And so I don't expect church to be a place where hypocrisy doesn't exist. I expect church to be a place where we name our hypocrisy and we're called to, by God, to heal from it, as Wilbur said, and to redeem it. We're called to be a part of a body that attempts to be honest about who we are and who we're called to be. And fundamentally, that's about loving God and loving neighbor. And because of our humanity, we can be often hypocritical about that. But church is a place to deal with that, to wrestle with that, and to ultimately grow from that experience.
So how do you create an appeal, though? You know, drawing people in, you saying, yes, this is a place where people can come and heal, bring all of your imperfections. But, you know, that's a tough sell, you know. How do you bring people into that and say, this is a place where you can find comfort?
One of the things that we did this past Sunday, and I think it's creating conversation and dialogue, interest and desire. This past Sunday, on the heels of the Colin Kaepernick deal with Nike, we themed our service Nike Sunday, Just Do It Sunday. And we said to our congregation, particularly our high schoolers, I challenged them, listen, on the heels of this whole Nike deal. The truth is not everybody's going to play ball and shoot baskets and those kind of things, but everybody can tap into. I asked our high schoolers, write me a one-page paper that says, here's my crazy dream in life. Here's what I want to accomplish and do. Turn that paper into us. This Sunday was the due date. In response to that, we said to them, just to create conversation and dialogue and let them know the church is concerned about them, we're giving away one to the top three writers of those papers. We're giving away $1,000 of Nike stock to each winner. That helps us to open up conversation and dialogue with millennials, to let them know that it's not always about us trying to get something from you. We're trying to get something to you. And then create conversation that opens us up to now spiritual, what we call spiritual conversation and dialogue.
That's Wilbur Purvis. He's with me, along with Kim Jackson and Anne Henley Saunders. They are all church leaders. And we're talking about how pastors are engaging and energizing and encouraging dynamism in their church. Now, Wilbur, I just need to pick up on that because you got a lot of flack for that, right? You had a lot of attention and a lot of flack.
I mean,
conservative groups were burning Nike clothing last weekend. So that's really putting down a stake. And we heard earlier in the program, Jonathan Merritt saying, you know, people are afraid of, they don't want to hear politics in the pulpit. So is it different? Well, how is it different for your church? And why did you make that decision?
I don't necessarily call that politics, though. I think the gospel of Jesus Christ is a social gospel. It's concerned about, when I say social, I mean it's concerned about the whole man, spiritually, financially, socially. It's concerned about the whole man. And I think that's what God calls us to, what Jesus calls us to do. And so we weren't making, this is not a Democrat or a Republican thing. This is, how do we make our community better? And we started with high schoolers.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. There are so many moral issues in today's political environment, you know, questions about rights of immigrants, LGBTQ issues, economic equality. So what's the role for a preacher inside of those social issues burning within the congregations? How about for you, Kim?
I think that people want to come to church and know that the things that they're wrestling with during the week are relevant and that our faith has something to say to those issues. And so it has to be done carefully and certainly prayerfully. But I think it's important for us to stand up in the pulpit and to talk about what's happening around us. If this is the conversation that everyone is having around the water cooler at work, why would we not say something about it from the pulpit?
Absolutely.
And make sure that we're clear about what Scripture has to say about this, what our church tradition has taught us over the years? Because while these issues are new, in so many ways they're not new, and certainly our faith can give us some perspective and some light into it. And I think our people come to church wanting that. They want to know, how do I have these conversations with my children or with my colleagues as a person of faith?
Well, you, Kim, you grew up in the Bible Belt. Right. Were you an Episcopalian then?
I was not. I was raised Baptist.
Well, when I was trying to educate myself about religion in the Bible Belt, I asked one of our elders here who said, what are the three things I really need to understand here about religious life in the South? And he said, Baptist, Baptist, Baptist. But, you know, now you're married to a woman, and your church supports same-sex couples, welcomes LGBT people from the community. Any pushback, though, from church members, or especially hierarchy?
Right. So the Episcopal Church has done a lot of work to come to a place, not only in terms of where we are intellectually, but theologically around the issues of LGBTQ welcoming. And so our church as a whole, from our presiding bishop, Michael Curry, all the way down to our local bishop, definitely supports. And I was ordained as an out queer woman in this church. But certainly we do get visitors who come in, and every once in a while I will preach and I'll mention my wife in a sermon. And I'll have someone who's not familiar with the Episcopal Church will say, wait a minute, how is this possible? And that's just, it opens a great door for us to be able to have a conversation about, I think, the sin of Christianity that perpetuated this myth that people who were gay are not welcome into the kingdom of God. And it also opens a door for us to begin to talk about what healing and restoration looks like for so many people who have been put off by historical ways of thinking about Christianity.
How about for you, Anne Henley, at the First Presbyterian Church of Atlanta? You know, the religion is, in many ways, many people adhere to it as an idea of these are fundamentals, these are absolute, these are truths, but then you're in a social environment that is asking for adaptation. Is that a tension for you in the church?
No. I find that my faith compels me to constantly evaluate and interpret scripture in light of my particular context, my particular faith community, and a larger global context, the larger body of Christ. Back to an earlier question, I think that the fundamental role of a pastor is to embody and reflect the truth. And also, back to an earlier point that you made about ego.
Yeah, we've rolled through a lot today.
Right? About ego. I think that ego, a constant question for me when engaging politics within the church and within the pulpit is whether or not I am speaking on behalf of my own ego or on behalf of my faith. And living, I think that the times that we find ourselves in require us to ask those questions and require us to live between a tension of silence and pride. Mm-hmm. And I think that not being silent and not being prideful, but being truthful about what are the non-negotiables when it comes to loving God and loving our neighbor, that's the most compelling witness for people of faith.
Ego really did come up a lot in my conversation with Jake Hall. You know, you are in this powerful place. You're standing in front of a congregation. People are listening to you. And now, of course, people can be filming you. I'm wondering about the social media phenomenon, the idea that you're not just speaking to people inside of your church, but potentially the whole world. Does that make you think differently about what you're presenting? Wilson.
I think it makes you, you know, in terms of preparation and being ready for what you're getting ready to say, speak on Sundays, you certainly have to cover all your bases and make sure that you are well studied because, you know, while you're right, while we're speaking, people can literally tweet. Not only tweet, but fact check. Is that really true what you're saying? And so it just calls you to really be prepared and do your due diligence.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have a thought about that? You're speaking to the whole world now.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about vulnerability. I think that it's important for pastors to have a certain amount of transparency with their congregation, particularly as we try to address this issue of hypocrisy. And so when I talk about my own brokenness, which I know we have some conversation about that word, but when I talk about my own brokenness, I'm aware that, wait, you know, 1,000 people might be hearing this, and am I prepared to confess to all these unknown people where my own sin is? And so I am really intentional and careful and have to be really humble about making that choice.
I think that's good, though. I think millennials want authenticity.
Absolutely.
I think they want transparency. I think in days past, we presented this image like I'm perfect or the leader is perfect or the leader has it all together. But I think when we can admit when we can be transparent and admit our flaws, it creates a bond with those in our congregation, especially millennials.
This is something that James wrote on Facebook in response to the conversation earlier. I haven't left the church. I'm a conservative evangelical. My parents were first-generation evangelicals. I think if you approach church with a consumerist mentality, so what does church do for me? You're going to be disappointed. But for those seeking God, church is essential. Is that it? Have we, like so much of our society, created a kind of, this is what's in it for you. This is a consumerist mentality. We got to wrap quickly, but thoughts on that? Anne Henley, you got a thought?
Yes, yes. I mean, I do think that there is an element of consumer marketing when you are speaking to a particular audience, a particular group of people. But in recognizing that within the particular community I find myself serving, it is a diverse family. It is a diverse family of not just millennials, but of many, it's intergenerational, and there is a lot of diversity of thought and theology even within one particular church. And in recognizing our own hypocrisy and recognizing a call to authenticity and truth-telling, I think that it's also important to recognize that in the wake of all that's going on in the world, it's important to take the pulse of the context, to take the pulse of the congregation, and recognizing that some weeks the congregation needs a caring message, mm-hmm. a pastoral care sermon, and other times they and I need a call to action. And in recognizing that every single week need not be the same.
That was Ann Henley Saunders from First Presbyterian Church of Atlanta, Wilbur Purvis from Destiny World Church in Austell, and Kim Jackson from All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta. Coming up, we're going to hear how one voice actor's start in improv led to a role on the TV show Archer. I'm Virginia Prescott, back after a short break with more on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. For 10 years, Atlanta native Amber Nash has voiced the strong-willed Pam Poovey on FXX's Archer.
I really like me.
Oh my God, Pam, I think you might be my best friend.
You're my best friend.
What about Cheryl?
You're my second best friend. Woo! I'm Pac-Man Jones!
Season 10 of the show is set to launch straight out of the stratosphere and into space. And we've snagged Amber while she is still on Earth to chat about her career and preview the new season. Amber, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for being here. Was voice acting on your list as a dream job?
No, I didn't actually. I'd never really considered it.
What did you want to be?
When I was very small, my first job that I wanted to be was a bus driver, because I thought that was just like the best job ever.
Everybody says hi to you.
Right. You're in charge of a big vehicle. It's great. And then I actually went to school. I went to get my bachelor's degree in psychology. That's what the plan was. And then I found acting and was like, wait a minute. My parents will hate that I want to do this. Let's go that route.
Did you ever work in psychology in the field?
I did, actually. When I graduated, I got actually a job in social work. I was working for the state of Georgia at a camp for teenagers with emotional and behavioral issues.
Wow, that's a heavy job.
But I grew up really fast. I got that job when I was 25. And it was incredible. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to put this aside for a while and try acting.
Really? So acting was the next choice. But you did work in radio for a while.
Well, I did. I did some radio spots here and there. That was kind of my first steps into doing voice work. Yeah. So I was kind of gigging as an improviser and an actor. And so I'd get little radio spot gigs and do those and learn on the job.
Do you remember any of the spots that you did?
You know, they were always like, they were in Georgia that I recorded them, but they were always for different markets. So it was like Baltimore, like a mattress firm or something in Baltimore. I don't remember any specifics, no, but they were always like, we need comedians to do like a little sketch in this commercial. So, yeah.
I've done those before, too. Yeah. It's just so weird. You know, you're supposed to, you take on a character, but I guess good training for an actor.
Totally.
Well, a lot of actors seem to migrate to Los Angeles or New York City, but you stayed here in Atlanta. Did you ever think about leaving for new opportunities?
I did. It was actually, it was something that I was always in the back of my mind. I was like, if I want to do this, I need to go to LA or New York. The thing was, is I was always working here. So I was like, why would I leave when I'm getting jobs as an actor to go somewhere where there's so many more actors and I'm not going to get any jobs? Mm-hmm. And then that kept going. And then the market in Atlanta exploded. And now people are moving from LA to Atlanta for work. So it's, I'm glad I wrote it out.
Well, and your rise, I guess, was at the same time or concurrent with the rise in roles and production here in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Well, so what was that like to witness?
It was really cool. It was actually very surprising. And there's a lot of people in the arts community in Atlanta that are like, hey, we're gonna stick to this. We're not going to leave. We're going to make the scene here. And there's a really cool indie art scene that happens here, too, that's really amazing. And I feel like we've got our own identity as artists, which is really cool.
How is it different than, you know, the acting community here in Atlanta and in Georgia than other cities?
I think one of the things that sets us apart is because we've always been our own smaller market, that if you want to do something here, you can make it happen. And that now that there's even more crew that's here and people that are looking for fun side jobs, something that's interesting to them that they'd be willing to do for not a lot of money, then you can make stuff happen. And so I think that people are willing to do their own interesting projects as opposed to what they think is going to be commercially viable or is going to sell or is going to get a casting director to look at them. I think people are more in it for the art in Atlanta.
Oh, so a different level of risk, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah, totally.
Level. And one of your earliest voice acting roles was for Adult Swim's Frisky Dingo. Let's hear just a clip.
Why does it say welcome to you are doom? What does that even mean? And why, for God's sakes, is doom in quotes?
I don't know.
Is this some sort of ironic doom? So please tell me how and why I'm suddenly a laughingstock.
Because you signed off on the proofs?
What was the setup like for Frisky Dingo?
You know what? This is so funny. Like, we were moving into season two of making that show, and I was starting to understand what the show was about, and I was like, I got to get out, because the show was so crazy that I don't really know what the show was about.
I actually don't even know what it was about. What was Frisky Dingo?
It was, I honestly still don't know, and I did both seasons. It's a very weird, very, very Adult Swim. It's got that, and it was one of the early Adult Swim shows, and it's got that, like, if you're looking for an Adult Swim show, that is one of them. It's like crazy, boys like it, you know. There was a character called Killface. I still don't know what the show was about. I just know the characters that I played.
What were your characters?
I played a character named Val, who in the beginning, for some reason, was always like in a kimono. She was an assistant of some kind. I really don't know. And then I played a lot of secondary characters. That was the fun part because they didn't have a lot of people and they just needed somebody that would show up, do their lines. They could call them and I'd be there in 10 minutes. And I could do some character voices. So I played several different characters, but I'm terrible with accents. So I can't do accents, but I can do different characters. And so I think I've probably played maybe 4 or 5 characters on the show.
How did you develop these characters? Was this something that just came as you were the kid who imitated people? Or,
you know, I was the kid that would screw around. I realized quickly, maybe like in like 3rd or 4th grade, if I wanted to make friends, that the best way for me to do it was to get people to laugh, because I wasn't like a sports kid. I wasn't, you know, there's like the cute kids and everybody just follows them around. I wasn't one of those. So I was just kind of weird and fringe. And I was like, if I play characters on the playground, people will get into it. And that's how I made friends. I had my very first character I ever played was on the playground. And it was, I called it Escaped Convict. And I would scream and run around and chase people. And people were like, this is awesome.
So when you decide to go into psychology, do your parents think, oh, that's a really good choice?
I think they were like, great, Amber, let's like make this something that's going to be something that people can look kindly on as opposed to just being insane.
But were you playing things out? I mean, I wonder about that. That sounds like a really developmentally advanced kid.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, maybe I just had a lot of things inside of me. And I didn't know exactly what to do with them, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm speaking with actor and Atlanta native Amber Nash. She plays Pam on FXX's Archer and appears at Dad's Garage in Atlanta. I want to get into Archer's 10th season because it's premiering this year.
Yep.
And the first episode introduces Pam as this mousy HR director. This is back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But she's evolved over the course of the seasons. What was your draw to her as a character?
Oh, man. Well, the thing was, in the beginning, I was just drawn to the job, right? I was like, I get a job and acting great. And then the show, I don't think I realized that the show, none of us did, that the show was going to become what it is.
And so I think, successful.
Yeah, I think it was, because I hadn't even met any of the other actors until season two was like halfway through.
Oh, right, as a voice actor, you never have to interact.
Right, because we were in Atlanta and they were making the show here, but everybody else was in LA and New York. And then I was like, oh, this has got a lot of famous people on it. You know, like Chris Parnell, I'd been watching him like my whole like growing up as a comedy person. So I was like so stoked to meet him. And then I think that once we realized that the show was successful and people were really starting to like Pam, because she was kind of just like she was a little bit of this, just the butt of the joke. That was kind of why she was developed. And then she started to progress into other things and have different sides of her and different skills. And she kind of became like a real formidable character, and people really started to appreciate her. And she kind of became this weird sex symbol too over time. And so I've watched her develop and grow. And I was actually at San Diego Comic-Con. This was a few years ago, and everybody's lined up to ask questions, and lots of people are in cosplay. And I see that there's like a Pam a few people back, and so I'm kind of waiting to hear from her. And she was the last person to get a question in before time was up, and she was in full Pam cosplay. And she started talking to the panel and saying that she was so excited that she finally had a character she could cosplay as that wasn't like fat Cinderella. Like, she could be just regular Pam. Mm-hmm. And she got teary-eyed, and everybody on the panel's getting teary-eyed, and we're like, so proud of this cartoon character. It's just really amazing the life that it's had.
For people who don't know Archer, can you give us the kind of setup of what the whole Archer scheme is?
Yeah, so it started out as this spy comedy meets office comedy with a bunch of people that are terrible human beings. And Archer, his mom was also part of the company, and his ex-girlfriend was part of the company, and there was lots of intermingling and office politics. And Pam was originally the HR director. And then through the seasons, Pam kind of became like a field agent as one of the spies. And then it all kind of exploded in season 5 when Archer went off the rails and did Archer Vice, which was like set like a Miami Vice kind of situation in Miami. And then we went back in season 6 to the regular world. And then since then, we haven't been back. And Archer is officially in a coma. And each season that's happening is kind of like a coma dream. There was a season that was film noir. There was a season that was like on a tropical island. And now we're in space. So there's something for everybody.
So what is that like to try on all these different iterations of the show? I mean, do you even have a clue when you show up that this is where we are now? We're on Fantasy Island, or we're in Miami, or
yeah,
whatever.
We usually get a phone call from Adam, the creator of the show, to kind of let us know, okay, so here's what I'm planning. The network has said yes, and so this is what we're going to do with it. So we always get a little bit of a hint. And the thing is that's cool is, like, the biggest one was in Archer Dreamland, which was the noir one, and I was playing a gender-neutral character that very much dressed like a man, and they told me that the character was based on Russell Crowe's character from L.A. Confidential. So as an actor that's been playing a character for 8 years, that's awesome, because you can't get bored. But the funny thing is I was like, well, do you want the character to sound any different? And they're like, nope, just the same. So it's kind of more subconscious. It's just coming from, you know, what, just knowing this in the back of my mind. And maybe it did change the performance a little bit. But at the end of the day, I think it's just fun to imagine this new kind of lens over the character. And this season, Pam's a gigantic rock monster.
Oh, can we get a preview of Pam's voice as rock monster, or is it just the same?
It's just the same.
This is working.
Yep.
Well, Archer's won a lot of critical acclaim and Critics' Choice Awards and been on for a decade. What is it about Archer that's built to last, do you think?
I think that we kind of struck a chord early on, and so we got a lot of people interested in the show that have stayed on as like hardcore fans. But I really think the longevity of it is because it's risky, like because we're changing stuff every season. And in the beginning, fans didn't like it. You know, you can't please everybody. And I think that if you have a comedy and you're not taking risks, then it's not a good comedy. And so you have to do that, and you have to make some people not happy and then make other people delighted. And so I think the fact that we're taking risks and changing it up and keeping it fresh is what is keeping the show alive for as long as it's been alive.
You've been a mainstay at Dad's Garage in Atlanta for a long time. What kind of energy and interaction do you get from improv versus voice acting when you're sitting in a studio, much like we're sitting in right now?
Yeah, it's so different. And I think the biggest thing was in the beginning, because I was a stage actor and I didn't have a lot of training doing microphone work or being in a studio, was that I would just like stand still with my arms by my side and like talk into the microphone. And I was actually doing some commercial work, and my friend Mike Schatz was like, you gotta move around in there. Like, we can hear that you're just a person standing completely still behind a microphone. And so now I have brought what I learned doing stage acting to the studio. So like, I move around, I hit the microphone, it's fine, we'll re-record it. Pam eats a lot, so I have to eat stuff in the studio, and I'm sweaty, and it feels like I've done a show when I leave the studio, like I like doing improv. But improv is always, stage acting is always my first love, because it's immediate feedback. You have an audience of people that are laughing and telling you that you're doing a great job, and it's just there, that it's you and that audience that one night. It's never going to happen again. You know, it's kind of magical.
But improv, of all things, that is the high wire act, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But you know, now it's like, because I've been doing it for so long, doing a scripted show to me is way more terrifying, because oh no, if I forget my line, then they're not going to be able to hit the sound cue, and then the whole thing's off the rails, and then the other actors can't do their lines. So there's no mistakes in improv. And so that's super freeing to me because I've been doing it so long.
And you were one of the, you've been what with the ensemble for what, 10 years or something?
Oh, almost 15.
Almost 15 years. And you were one of the first women
in the
group. What did that feel like?
Oh, boy. I mean, it's so different now to look at the theater composition versus back then. There had been one woman before me that was in the ensemble named Kendra, and she left, and it was 2 years before another woman was put in the ensemble, which was me. So it was all boys. Like, it was like having 12 older brothers, and it still is sometimes. But I would get notes from other women that would travel to our theater that were from theaters that had more women, and they would tell me that I improvised like a man. And I was like, well, I just had to improvise.
What does that even mean?
Exactly. I was like, maybe I played more male characters, or I had to do things that the men in the group responded to. And so I think I probably did have to elbow and be a little bit tougher to get in, to get my voice heard. But then when women started coming around and more women started staying at the theater, not just taking classes and leaving, the story started to change, and the scenes would be different, and we were telling different stories because we were telling stories with more diverse voices. And now it's such a different theater, and it's really awesome to watch everybody grow and learn and be more diverse. It's great.
You also did a 2015 web series with the folks from Dad's Garage. It's called Heart, H-A-R-T, of America. It chronicled the weirdness of the country. It was set in a state park. So what was the inspiration for that?
So my husband, who is the artistic director at Dad's Garage, Kevin Galise, he had an old partner. He's from Canada. And his old partner that he used to do improv with, Arlen, the way that they improvise is very specific, and they use that as a template, that format as a template for writing. So they wrote in the style of their improv. So it's they do three different stories that start to weave together towards the end. So that's what we had. We had three different stories that I played the main character of each of those stories, and then the narrator. So I play four completely different characters, my favorite being an old man. And then all the stories kind of weave together in a 10-episode web series. It was incredibly fun.
What's your old man voice?
It's pretty similar. Everybody at Dad's knows it because I love playing old men at the theater. It's kind of like, well, looks like you're not from around here. He's always hiding behind a bush.
It's funny watching you because your face changes when you do the different characters. Well, thank you so much. What a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Amber Nash, she's an Atlanta native, and she's an actor and voice actor. You can check her out in Atlanta at Dad's Garage, where she is a member of the ensemble. And the 10th season of Archer on FX premieres later this year. And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Don Smith is our Dean of Grammar. Alec Kaslow, our engineer, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.